For Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is a Haunted Halloween Arizona Spotlight. It's time once again to light the jack-o'-lantern and turn up your radio, because we've got a collection of seasonal stories designed to thrill and chill. If you don't believe in ghosts, then good for you, because we're going to visit some of Tucson's most haunted places and explore the fears that keep people up at night. Those stories and more are coming up on the 6th Annual Haunted Halloween Arizona Spotlight. That's the sound of organist Dorothy Papadakis. She recently visited Tucson as a guest of the Friends of Music at St. Philip's in the Hills Episcopal Church. There, she accompanied the 1922 silent film Nosferatu on the church's historic pipe organ. A diverse audience gathered to experience one of the greatest horror movies of all time, together in the dark. Zach Ziegler and I talked with some of them about the Halloween season.
Hi, I'm Sarah.
I'm Chloe.
I'm Abby.
I'm Ruby.
I'm Alistair.
I'm Ben.
Is Nosferatu different than the kind of vampires that you guys know from Twilight and stuff like that?
No, those are not vampires.
Okay.
Those are fairy princesses.
Yeah.
These are real vampires.
These are like Bram Stoker Dracula vampires.
Real ones.
I can't deal with horror movies.
Neither can I.
So I'll probably be screaming.
Okay, so let me ask you this. Are you going to go trick-or-treating this year?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes,
of course. Depends if we get turned down this year or
why
not.
Why would we turn down for free candy?
I know. That's why we can go.
What's something that would be a treat to find in your bag, and what's something that would be a trick?
Like a giant raisins. Candy bar, and then like...
A giant dinosaur.
And then something disappointing would be a toothbrush.
I was given popcorn and cocoa mix.
I hate it when people give out like those fake spider rings because they're cheap.
I would love to get like strawberries or something because
she's a fruit.
No,
fanatic.
I get sweet.
The girl hates ice cream.
The scariest thing to get in your Halloween bag would be
like a shark.
Yeah. Or something to do with Twilight.
My house never gets trick-or-treaters though.
No, ours either. Perks of a cul-de-sac.
Have you ever thought about, though, when it might be time when you won't be able to go trick-or-treating?
No. I will go trick-or-treating until
we're, like, about 35.
Yeah, and then I'll just take my kids trick-or-treating
and
take their candy.
We have already gotten a few interesting people. You know, you walk up and you have a group of kids in front of you, and the adults are like, oh, here you go, and they have like handfuls of candy, and we come up and it's like one dum-dum with a scowl that we get.
I think I'll go trick-or-treating till I'm in college, and then in college I'll probably just go to parties.
In college you could go dorm trick-or-treating or something.
Meanwhile, inside the church, Zach talked with a few former trick-or-treaters.
If I say the word scary, first thing that pops into your mind?
Well, I just saw the movie Gravity. That was the most terrifying experience of my life. It was 90 minutes of sheer panic. So I think outer space is the scariest thing I can think of right now.
Driving in Tucson can be like that sometimes.
When I say scary, what's the first thing that pops into your head?
Chemistry. I just had a nasty test, so yeah.
Mummies. I would say that... mummies were doing the scary undead thing way before vampires were. You know, a mummy is someone who was a king in their time, and they've been reduced to this shambling monstrosity that doesn't actually have any power over the physical world, but they have this incredible mental prowess, and they have this sort of depth of ages thing going to them, which I think is actually pretty cool. Very interesting.
What is scary to you?
Scorpions. Scorpions are scary to me. Dracula, the old Dracula movie, the old American one. Those type of movies.
Bela Lugosi.
Yeah.
Classic scare.
There is no map to what people refer to as the spirit realm, but there may be places where the borders overlap. Laura Palmisano investigates a list of places in Pima County where apparitions have been reported.
As Halloween approached, Mark McLemore asked me if I knew a librarian in Tucson who collects ghost stories. I told him I didn't know the person he was searching for, but offered to help him find them. While searching the internet for this librarian, I came across a collection of articles on the Pima County Public Library's website. They are called the Librarian Files. One article that caught my attention is called Ghosts in Tucson. It's a list of about 30 locations across Pima County where ghosts have allegedly been sighted. I got in touch with Sarah Hayden, the librarian who oversees the files, in hopes of learning more about the ghost list.
The librarian files are, right now, they're actually an electronic resource available through our library website. But what they began as a long time ago is actually a collection of paper files. They were made up of things that our staff members found in the course of answering our community's questions. The idea is sort of like, think of, you know, your grandma's recipe box, but with more news articles.
Sarah said she doesn't know who originally created the Ghosts in Tucson entry.
This is a list that I inherited that had been put in the librarian files some time ago. Basically, it's a list of places that we've heard in the Pima County area where people have reported hauntings or ghost sightings. We're actually in the process right now of editing our librarian files to make sure that we have verifiable and authoritative information for all of them. This is a file that we haven't had the chance to edit yet, so we cannot vouch for, you know, the information on that page.
I decided to check out one of the locations on the list. David Slutz, the entertainment director for Hotel Congress, took me on a tour of some of the haunted rooms in the almost century-old hotel.
We rent room 242. It's the last room we rent because it still has that, dare say, shining vibe to it. Some woman came to sort of a untimely end there, and it seems to have inhabited the room ever since. In fact, our maids have, without even telling us, put a lot of religious iconography in the room just to sort of dim the spirits, the bad spirits that she brings into that room. But we still rent the room. People love to do it because it is the ghostiest room of all. We also have Vince, who came off the train in 1965 and checked into room 220 and stayed there until 2001, where he passed away. Well, Vince was part of this building. He was an old curmudgeon, and I knew Vince. And about a year and a half after he passed away, the maids are coming to me, David, Vince is bothering us again, because he always never got along with the maids. He'd always go down to the restaurant, get his little bagel plate and his little butter knife, and always leave it in the room. And say, Vince, you have to bust your own stuff. Well, a year and a half after he passed away, the butter knife and the bagel plate started reappearing in the room. And the maids were really mad at Vince for, after passing away, still bothering them. True story.
Yeah. And there's Tiger. Tiger, do you have any ghost stories?
Ghost stories? I've just seen them on the wall, but they all disappeared 2 years ago. They all went back upstairs. Yeah, they were on the walls. They didn't want a drink, so I guess they went upstairs where all the action was. They don't bother me.
Some of the other locations on the list include Colossal Cave, where the ghost of Frank Schmidt supposedly haunts the cave. The Pioneer Hotel, where the screams of people who were killed in a fire are reportedly heard. And even the Modern Languages Building, where our station is on the University of Arizona campus. The apparition of a woman in a white dress allegedly haunts the building, but I haven't seen her. Sarah said the Ghosts in Tucson file might not be around for much longer if the library can't confirm the information.
If we are able to find, you know, an authoritative and verifiable source, it is more likely that that information would remain in the file. Otherwise, we would have to remove it, because we're pretty dedicated to presenting our community with good information that we can point to a source for.
For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Laura Palmisano.
Tucson offers a wide variety of thrift store shopping. But have you ever wondered about the history that might be behind your latest bargain? Reports of some otherworldly activity at one local thrift store aroused the curiosity of Yu Young Jung and Kayla Samoy. What they discovered suggests that the items in the store may be collecting more than just dust.
Betty Blue's Junk Shop is an antique resale store in town. It's got everything from Recessa babies to old records to mannequin faces. Something strange has been happening there lately.
We caught wind of it, so we're here at Betty Blue's Junk Shop today to see for ourselves what really is going on.
And then on the video, like, you see this fall and then these kind of...
That's Kim, the owner, talking to paranormal investigators she's invited to find out whether there really are spirits.
She says the activities began shortly after a shop moved into the building on South Plumer Avenue.
We heard voices, conversations happening that we couldn't pinpoint.
Kim says she was able to nail down when and where things were happening after she got security cameras. She and her employee Lisa went through hours of footage to find out that it was more than just things accidentally falling over.
And she started posting those videos on Facebook, where Tucson researchers investigating paranormal sightings or trips saw them and asked Kim if they could come by and check out the shop. Rebecca is one of the trip's investigators.
We do audio recordings with digital voice recorders. We use various video equipment with infrared vision, night vision, full spectrum. We use still cameras.
One type of equipment Trips uses is something called the Spirit Box. Carrie, another Trips investigator, explains what it does.
It's like a modified radio. And the theory is with the sweep rate, it scans through all the frequencies. And spirits can supposedly manipulate this energy to form words or sentences.
The investigators asked if we wanted to try the Spirit Box. So we turned down the lights and fired it up in the middle of Betty Blue's junk shop.
And what we heard was a bit unsettling.
We have a couple of new guests this evening, and we're hoping that you'll at least speak up and say hello for us. As always, we come here with absolute respect. We mean you no harm, no disrespect. We're not here to chase you away or ask you to leave.
How many spirits are here with us tonight?
70?
Did you answer 70?
I think it's the prankster at work.
Yeah, it doesn't mean there's 70 here. It just means that's what they said. So,
I mean, it'd be awfully crowded.
So there probably aren't 70 spirits at Betty Blue's, but hearing a clear response was a bit perplexing to our skeptical minds.
But we kept asking more questions. We had to be sure that this was not just a coincidence.
I need help.
Does someone need help?
But we never could figure out what exactly the spirit needed help with.
Maybe it was cookies. Trip's investigator Rebecca says the spirits wanted cookies, so they brought some and placed them on the counter.
So even though that I need help part was pretty scary, these spirits at Betty Blue's don't seem to want to hurt people. Rebecca from the investigators is quite sure that the spirits at Betty Blue's are just pranksters.
As a group, we agree that there is nothing malicious or harmful, threatening in any way. What we suspect is, for whatever reason, at least three spirits, entities, whatever you want to call them, people call them different things, are attracted to this location. They're comfortable here, and they seem to have a sense of humor, almost like pranksters.
So what could be causing them to linger here? Deb, one of the investigators, says she's not sure.
There could be an attachment, like we just discussed earlier, attachment to the owner, or to the area, or to anything, any of the people that have been in and out.
The owner, Kim, still doesn't know why or how these paranormal events are happening.
Yeah, I've never had any experiences before. Like, I wouldn't consider myself sensitive or anything like that, but I would say I'm an open-minded skeptic. I mean, when stuff happens that you can't explain, and you can catch video and audio evidence of it, and you still can't explain it.
We asked the neighbor if he'd seen anything strange. Mike Blass is always around in the area because his wife owns Laverna's Diner, which is right next door to Betty Blue's.
And when we asked him if he'd noticed any paranormal activities around here...
Nothing.
Nothing at all?
There's a few strange customers from time to time, but otherwise, it's pretty normal. I've never seen anything here.
But we did hear those voices from the spirit box. That's something that cannot be denied.
They could have been spirits or ghosts. They could have been something else. But it definitely didn't seem human.
So believe what you want. But Betty Blue's junk shop may actually be home to wandering spirits who just want to have some fun. I'm Kayla Samoy.
And I'm Yuhyun Jung.
For Arizona Spotlight.
The sight of slimy orange innards from smashed jack-o'-lanterns is all too common in the days following Halloween. Next, Zach Ziegler tells us about pumpkin destruction that's not vandalism.
the young people of Tucson choose one weekend a year to wheel their torturous devices into place. They want everyone to see the efficiency with which their instruments hurl their victims.
3, 2, 1.
They count down the seconds until they heave their prey through the air and see who goes furthest. It's a pretty sick contest. Oh, the humanity! Wait, they're not tossing people, they're tossing pumpkins? Oh, the pumpkinity! In all reality, the Tucson Pumpkin Toss isn't a horrifying exhibition of cruelty. It's a display of amazing ingenuity by Tucson's bright young minds.
It's an opportunity for most children of all ages, including including grown-ups who have better things to do with their time, to exercise their ingenuity and see if they can create a catapult or some kind of device to throw a pumpkin.
That's Bruce Bailey, one of the organizers of the Pumpkin Toss. While the competition is open to all ages, it is comprised mostly of teenagers. Bailey says the project started as a way to get young people involved in what are commonly called STEM subjects: science, technology, engineering, and math.
I believe we've succeeded. We have huge numbers of youngsters who are involved in designing and building their own catapults.
That designing, building, testing, and tweaking takes some serious knowledge. Most of the designs are trebuchets. Think your typical conception of what would be used to knock down the wall of a medieval castle. And they can launch a pumpkin more than the length of a football field. They also take some serious dedication. Alex Utzinger and his teammates on Bitbuckets have spent more than a year on their trebuchet.
We've been working on this trebuchet for a long time. This is kind of our trebuchet also from last year, but we've changed many things about it, and we've done a lot more testing than we did last year.
This year's winner, built by students from Saurita High School's MESA program, stands 23 feet tall and tossed a pumpkin 120 meters. Team Captain Damian Willer has learned a lot in building the machine he calls Der Kaiser.
Doing stuff like this, it just helps with getting a basic understanding of how these machines work and whatnot. It's a lot of troubleshooting with these things. It took us a long time to get it firing.
And competitor Henry Norbrook has trouble describing the joy many take in a pumpkin toss.
This is amazingly fun. Seeing something go flying is something that's really, really hard to capture on a video. It just has none of the same impact as having to throw your hand in front of the sun because you're leaning back way too far to see that pumpkin go flying.
It's a lesson in physics and hard work hidden behind medieval siege weapons and a field of gooey, shattered pumpkins. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Zach Ziegler.
In real life, actors Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff shared mutual respect and a cordial friendship as Hollywood's most popular boogeymen. Between 1934 and 1940, they made 8 films together, but rarely did both of their characters survive to the end credits. Next, Chris DeShiel confesses his appreciation for one of Boris and Bela's strangest collaborations.
Universal Studios dominated the successful horror film genre of the 1930s. The studio's films, starring characters like Dracula, Frankenstein, and the Wolfman, had an unmistakable style, largely due to the expressionistic flair of directors like Todd Browning, James Whale, and Carl Freund. But how can I explain my affection for the least typical of Universal's horror films, 1934's The Black Cat, directed by Edgar G. Ulmer? It won't be easy, because by most conventional measures concerning story, dialogue, or even just plain scariness, The Black Cat would usually be judged absurd, a failure, even a bad film.
Supernatural, perhaps. Baloney, perhaps not.
But it's the utterly unique qualities of this movie that fascinates me. The way that gothic elements have been pared down to the point of abstraction, through which we can hear a faint, sad, and poetic melody. The opening credits say, suggested by the Edgar Allan Poe story, and that's nonsense. This film has nothing whatsoever to do with the Poe story. There is a black cat in the film, and one of the characters has a phobia of cats, but it's pretty meaningless, and I suspect the cat was put in there so they could use the title. The original story was put together by Ulmer and a pulp fiction writer named Peter Rurik. Bela Lugosi plays an Austrian doctor, recently released from prison, who seeks revenge against a mad former officer and engineer played by Boris Karloff, who stole Lugosi's wife and seduced his daughter. Karloff has designed a futuristic castle in Hungary and built it on the very ruins of the fort he betrayed to the enemy during World War I. Into this situation stumbles a pair of American newlyweds played by David Manners and Jacqueline Wells. Karloff, wearing a bizarre triangular haircut and a uniform that looks a little like a bathrobe, decides to sacrifice the young wife in a satanic ritual. Once we're in the castle, the characters move in weirdly regimented fashion, striking poses to an overbearing soundtrack of Schubert, Beethoven, and Tchaikovsky. A key scene revolves around Karloff challenging Lugosi to a game of chess.
Do you dare play chess with me for her?
Yes. I will even play you chess for her, provided if I win, they are free to go.
You won't win, Vitus.
In some mysterious way, they're playing for the life of the young woman. Well, the nonsensical plot can inspire laughter, especially if you're watching the film with others. Yet at the same time, this is not an inept Ed Wood-style travesty. In fact, the motifs that Ulmer introduces, practically unmoored from what we usually think of as context, were shocking in their day, and perhaps were not as shocked, only because we're watching it 80 years later. Audiences must have been startled seeing Karloff roam the dark halls of his castle, where glass cases contain the corpses of women he has murdered, dressed in white and evidently stuffed as in taxidermy, in standing positions as if they were floating midair. One of the highlights is the satanic ritual, in which a group of cultists gather around an X-shaped altar to watch Karloff intone the Black Mass in Latin, all done with strange camera angles and disorienting use of space. But the finest touch of all comes practically from out of nowhere. After Lugosi botches a murder attempt, Karloff talks quietly to him. As he speaks, the camera rises through the rooms of the castle, moving hypnotically through the hallways in gentle rhythm with his voice. It touches on the sad undercurrent of the film, the obscenity of the war in which millions died for nothing.
Of what use are all these melodramatic gestures? You say your soul was killed, that you have been dead all these years. And what of me? Did we not both die here in Marmaris 15 years ago? Are we any the less victims of the war than those whose bodies were torn asunder? Are we not both the living dead?
Edgar G. Ulmer was an Austrian Jewish emigre who came to the U.S. as an assistant to F.W. Murnau, one of cinema's all-time greatest directors. From the master, he inherited a love of the slow tracking shot and the innovative use of screen space and lighting for emotional effect. He was a true independent, working for small producers on the margins of the industry, all his life having to work within tiny budgets, making B-films. The Black Cat was the only film he directed for a major Hollywood studio. Universal wanted to capitalize on the success of Dracula and Frankenstein by putting the two stars, Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff, in their first movie together. Nevertheless, it was a very low-budget production by Hollywood standards. If you go to The Black Cat with expectations concerning style and narrative, you're bound to be disappointed. Strangely, the characters seem motivated by forces outside of the script, as if they symbolize taboos to be broken. Devil worship, necrophilia, torture, incest, even drug addiction gets hinted at, which is all very heavy stuff for 1934, although sadly, not so much anymore. Plus, Lugosi got to play the good guy for once. Sort of. You know, I was tempted to call The Black Cat one of my guilty pleasures, but on reflection, I have to say, I don't feel guilty at all. For Arizona Spotlight, this is Chris DeShiel wishing you a happy Halloween.
Throughout this show, we've heard many stories about restless spirits. Regardless of what form you believe spirits may take, it's part of many traditions that we try to be at peace with them. Here is an essay.
My name is Anna Augustowska, and I'm from Wrocław, Poland. I first came to Tucson in 2008 to visit a family friend. I remember it clearly. It was late October, and my friend from Tucson said, "Since it's your first time in the US, and it's this time of the year, you should go and see how we celebrate the Day of the Dead." Still jet-lagged and under cultural shock, I went to the All Souls procession. There, I saw a variety of people celebrating and mourning the lives of their loved ones at the same time. The idea of celebrating death surprised me as much as their costumes and artifacts. I recall one woman who had a skeleton painted over her belly. She was, I think, 6 months pregnant. I came up to her and asked, "Aren't you superstitious?" "I'm not," she said. "This will bring good luck." The events from Tucson remind me of how different the celebration of those who passed is in my home country, Poland. Our observance is neither loud nor colorful, but it does bring people together, as the All Souls procession does. In Slavic tradition, both days, All Saints and All Souls Day, happens every year on the first and second day of November. They are devoted in particular to praying for the souls. On those days, Polish cemeteries are full of people who come to visit the graves of their loved ones. The candles are lit and the flowers are placed. People talk about those who passed and how their passing changed their lives. 2 years ago, I lost my mother. She died of cancer. If I were still there in Poland, I would go visit her grave today. My father sent me a picture of it the other day. He put flowers and candles. It looks beautiful. Although I live in Tucson now, I will connect with her this year from the All Souls procession. I may not be ready to carry her photo, nor wear a skeleton costume myself, but since souls don't recognize borders or distance, I know she will be there with me. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Anna Augustowska.
Thank you for listening to the 6th annual Haunted Halloween Arizona Spotlight. Our organist has been Dorothy Papadakis. Additional music by Calexico. On behalf of audio engineer Jim Blackwood and contributors Laura, Yu Yun, Kayla, Anna, Zach, Chris, Boris, and Bella, I'd like to wish everyone a very safe and extremely scary Halloween weekend.